the long metal barrel of a cannon resting on the edge of a trench.
It's been said that in time of war, the first casualty is truth. During the First World War, the truth died every day alongside soldiers whose suffering was obscured by big words like honor and civilization, and big lies like, this was the war to end all wars. But on one battlefield, in a place called Gallipoli, the truth, though wounded, lived to tell a tale.
A man starts to type on an old typewriter. Keith Murdoch, 23rd of September, 1915.
I now write of the unfortunate Dardanelles expedition. It is undoubtedly one of the most terrible chapters in our history.
I've always kept in mind very much the legacy of my father and the influence he had on me. And, you know, I have his picture prominently on the wall of my study at home.
A black and white photo of him holding a hat.
In the autumn of 1915, Keith Murdoch wrote a first-hand report on the Gallipoli campaign. This young Australian journalist described how a daring military adventure had gone disastrously wrong. And he didn't pull his punches.
Excerpts from his writings.
To take fresh, raw, untried troops under amateur officers and to fling them against such trenches was murder.
According to legend, the Gallipoli letter toppled a general, shook a government, and helped to end a bloodbath. But between the legend and the truth lies a no-man's land of bitter argument still being fought over today.
The classical view is that we have a courageous man who defies military censorship in order to save our soldiers from a disastrous campaign that is doomed to fail. The truth is far more complicated.
There's a pom-bashing element in the Anzac legend. These young Australians being sent to their death by the British encapsulates a modern idea of what Gallipoli is about.
I think it was a reflection, of his emotional anger at what he saw. It wasn't just an outburst, it was sympathy, it was anger. And I think, it saved a lot of lives.
The idea that Murdoch's letter ended the Gallipoli campaign and saved thousands of lives is the kind of story reporters tell each other over a quiet drink.
Of course, we want to try and tell the truth, but on the other hand, most of us are driven predominantly by personal ambition and a lust for adventure. And boy, Keith Murdoch understood how to promote Keith Murdoch.
A century after the battle for Gallipoli was fought with blood, bone, and bullet, it's time to tell the story of a battle fought with words, ink, and paper. A battle in which reputations fell, careers were born, and the foundations of a new empire were laid.
My father certainly shook up the establishment, and I think I've shaken them up over a longer period and a lot more.
Letters appear on an old typewriter keyboard, spelling out Gallipoli, when Murdoch went to war. The sheet of paper's removed. Gallipoli, when Murdoch went to war. Jerky old black and white film of London and Big Ben. Monday the 5th of February 1917, and Murdoch sitting on a chair outside a door.
In February 1917, an Australian newsman called Murdoch was called before an official inquiry.
He steps into the room and the door closes.
The Dardanelles Commission was investigating the disaster known as Gallipoli. The commission had heard from generals, admirals, and politicians. Now it was the journalist's turn to account for what he had done. But unlike his son, who recently found himself in a similar situation, this was not to be Murdoch Senior's humblest day.
Questioning by Sir William Pickford.
You were on the staff of one of the Melbourne newspapers, I suppose?
I am manager of the United Cable Service Australasia, here in London. Our service, which is headed by the Sydney Sun and Melbourne Herald, two very substantial and powerful newspapers, has an agreement with the London Times.
You are not on the Times' regular staff, I understand.
Our office is in the Times office, under the discipline of the Times, and with a salary paid by the Times proprietor. You can call it being on the staff, if you like. Though I see General Sir Ian Hamilton, in the course of a lot of misstatements contained in his submission to the Commission, says it's a lie.
Black and white film of an old soldier.
I lived for war and by war. War was my life.
This is Sir Ian Standish Monteith Hamilton, DSO, GCB, GCMG, and Commander-in-Chief of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force to Gallipoli, until he was monstered by Murdoch and his infamous letter.
I have a perfectly clear conscience. I went to London and I hit Sir Ian Hamilton as hard as I could. I thought the vital thing was to get a fresh mind on the spot. The British Cabinet confirmed this view by recalling him within a week of my report being discussed by it, and he was not again employed.
The model of journalism that Keith embraced was not the model of being the observer that sits on the sidelines, the person that does the observing and the reporting in a neutral, unbiased way. Keith wasn't afraid to get on in there and use the leverage and exercise these new levers of power as he saw it.
So you use the methods of the populist and sensationalist press in order to achieve the things that you might want to achieve. It's very similar to the sort of thing that his son does.
Rupert Murdoch, Keith Murdoch's son.
He'd had to battle very hard to establish a career in journalism. He'd always wanted that, apparently. But he suffered from a terrible stammer. And they thought he could never be a journalist or ask questions. But the owner of the Melbourne Age was a friend of his father. They played golf together. And he agreed to let him be a penny a line journalist.
His father is a very prominent Presbyterian minister in Melbourne who connects him with the Melbourne establishment. He wishes, like many products of Victorian England, to get on, to better himself. He believes in that.
He couldn't go into the family line of business and be entering the church. He was very conscious that he wouldn't be able to stir people from the pulpit, yet he still retained this great will to be a power for good, as he put it, and useful in the world. But he saw that through his pen.
But I mean, first of all, they had to go to London to try and get a job, but try to overcome the stutter.
Old black and white film of horse-drawn carriages on a busy London street.
When he arrives here in England in 1908, he's a young boy of 23. And the critical thing, I think, to say about Keith Murdoch in that early period is how open-minded he seems, how unformed are his political convictions at this time. He is appalled by the poverty in London. He is appalled by the prostitution on the streets. And he's dismissive of royalty and the show of royalty, calls it all beastly humbug. So he's learned that egalitarian turn of mind to be cynical of the rich and powerful. He is also aware how easily led the people can be, the power of the press to influence them.
It is as easy to play upon the feelings and emotions of the British public as it is to whip up highly strung horses. I'll be able to learn ever so much here. That's very evident. And with health, I should become a power in Australia.
Towards the end of the time in London in 1909, Keith had set himself one more chance to really try and break through into Fleet Street. He felt that all the exercises with his speech that he'd done, all the practice he'd put into that, had got him into the position that he could actually give it a real shot and try and hold his own in the interview.
I told you of the excellent chance I had of getting good work at the Pall Mall Gazette. I passed all the tests. And then when it got to the final effort, the few minutes talk with the editor, my speaking collapsed. And of course, we both realized that I would not do.
And I'm afraid that was the time that his first London trip came to an end, and he had to retreat to Australia to try and regroup and start his career there again. He was absolutely distraught by this.
Exploiting his family connections once more, Keith Murdoch landed a job as a parliamentary correspondent in Melbourne. And that is where his brilliant career might have stalled. Except that in the summer of 1914, the biggest news story of the age broke. The empires of Europe went to war, taking the rest of the world with them.
When I was a young man,
the Australia War Memorial in London.
My pack, and I lived the free life.
A black and white photo of men looking at a placard that says, "This space is reserved for a fit man." Then another photo of a group of ordinary looking men in hats, some with their shirt sleeves rolled up. Now an army officer standing in front of rows of men, still in civilian attire.
My country said, son,
a photo of a row of men saluting, some still in their civvies. Now a queue of bare-chested men undergoing a medical.
And they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war.
A group of men now in army uniform. Author Douglas Newton.
Australia offer an expeditionary force to Britain, 20,000 men, under British command, for any objective, to any location. Britain is to control absolutely the troop force sent. The great bulk of the troops who volunteered originally must have volunteered under the impression they were going to England. All the newspapers told them so. And that's a very significant inducement. In a big liner, that trip back to the home country, where we shall cut a figure beneath the gaze of the mother country, a place of honour in the line in Flanders and France. However, in the first weeks of November, of course, all hell breaks loose, a vast escalation of the war into the Middle East. So a week out from the arrival of the troops in Egypt, they are told that is where they are being stopped. They are not going to Britain. Their fate is being determined by high diplomacy.
A photo of a soldier feeding a kangaroo with the pyramids in the background.
While Australians and New Zealanders trained beneath the pyramids, in Whitehall, the British War Cabinet debated a bold scheme that would ultimately bring the Anzacs to Gallipoli and Keith Murdoch to his finest hour.
In the winter of 1914, it became clear that the Western Front had lapsed into stalemate. So what was to be done? Winston Churchill managed to persuade some of his cabinet colleagues that there was a soft underbelly of the Central Powers, that there was a way round, that they could attack from the south to try and knock Turkey out of the war.
Sir Max Hastings, historian and former war correspondent.
November 1914, the Ottoman Empire declares a holy war, and that is a threat to a British Empire that is the ruler of more Muslims than any other state in the world. So the need to knock Turkey out of the war has a very clear strategic justification. The essence of the plan is to use the Navy to get through the Straits and be able to appear outside Constantinople.
The idea was that this would probably cause the Ottoman Empire to collapse. Battleship diplomacy rather than gunboat diplomacy, or gunboat diplomacy on a much larger scale.
The campaign is essentially sold on the basis that it could be ships alone. The ships might be able to do it without boots on the ground.
Sir Hugh Strachan, author of The First World War, now Bill Sellers.
On the 18th of March, The fleet approached. It must have been a magnificent spectacle. It was one of the largest gatherings of a modern fleet in warfare up to that time. The fleet sailed slowly, majestically, if you like, into the Dardanelles. And still, the Ottoman gunners didn't open fire. They were just waiting, luring the fleet in. And as they started to come in, they started pounding the fleet.
Cannons pointed at the sea, then old footage of ships being blasted. A photo of smoke rising up from a ship. Professor Peter Doyle, military historian.
The British Navy was the strongest navy in the world at this period, but it was an arrogance in some sense that the British and French thought that they could send their ships through. On that day, they lost three major capital ships that went to the bottom of the Straits of the Dardanelles.
Ian Hamilton was off the coast that day on a light cruiser, and he saw the battle. And I think at that time, he and many of the military officers realised that the fleet had shot its bolt. It wasn't going to fight its way through the straits on its own. Modern phrase, boots on the ground. We're going to be needed.
Present day, a boat comes into dock and people get off. John Lee, Sir Ian Hamilton's biographer.
Ian Hamilton was the most senior general on the British Army's active list. He'd been a soldier since 1870, and the German Great General Staff in 1914 said he was the most experienced soldier alive in anybody's army anywhere in the world.
General Sir Ian Hamilton's quite an unusual general altogether. He is has liberal tendencies, small L, big L. So he's not your usual Tory general.
Extremely well educated, a published writer, a published poet. The Japanese army adored him because he was a soldier poet, their ideal.
Oh, no, he's far from being a blimp. He was a thinking soldier. And he wasn't a bully, and I think that was one of the problems, really, that he wasn't forceful enough. You know, military people recently have not been frightened to tell their political masters, sorry, we need more.
There was no plan, literally no plan, and no experience. The army produced a thing called the Manual of Combined Military and Naval Operations. This was a guide for anybody having to land on an enemy coast. But I have to stress that you weren't supposed to land on a defended beach. It was a plan for landing a large number of troops on a fairly quiet part of the enemy's coastline, get ashore and then conduct the fighting inland. Nobody had ever, in the whole history of warfare, assaulted a beach defended by machine guns and modern rifles. Never in human history. And the boys on the front line had to plan it all in 33 days. We planned D-Day for 2 years, OK? We planned Gallipoli in 33 days.
To take Gallipoli, Hamilton had at his disposal 37,000 British and Indian troops, 20,000 Anzac troops, and a 16,000-strong contingent from France. Gallipoli produced many heroes. Rarely have so many been unsung.
Most Australians would be disbelieving if you told them that far more British and French soldiers died at Gallipoli than Australians. But the whole myth or legend of Australians as victims of monstrous British incompetence and insensitivity still has an extraordinary grip on the Australian people.
Battlefield historian Bill Sellers.
Just before first light, about 4:30 in the morning, 4:25, sharp-eyed Turkish observer based in these hills here would have just seen a line of rowing boats slowly moving in towards the shore. The first waves of Australian troops, 1,500 in that first wave, men of the 3rd Australian Brigade, have been towed from warships in the offing out here, brought in by small steamboats, picket boats, and 50, 80 metres from shore they were unleashed. Toes were dropped, and these men literally had to row for their lives.
Battle of Gaba Tepe. Australians cover themselves with glory, at the Turks with cold steel. Wonderful grit and dash, a graphic description.
It was a bayonet charge, a wild and sometimes disorganised rush up into the hills, driving the Turks before them.
The Australians did not wait for orders, but sprang into the sea and rushed at the enemy's trenches. Their magazines were not charged, so they just went in with cold steel, and it was over in a minute.
The landing at Anzac Cove is the day when the Australian army stands up, or Australian manhood, or all Australians stand up to be noticed on the world stage.
They found themselves facing an almost perpendicular cliff. Here was a tough proposition to tackle in the darkness, but this race of athletes proceeded to scale the cliffs. They lost some men, but did not worry.
They get there, they run up the hillside, climb a cliff, a moral cliff, some put it that way, and they manage to hang on.
Though many were shot to bits and without hope of recovery, their cheers resounded throughout the night. They were happy because they knew they had been tried for the first time and had not been found wanting.
A black and white photo of the time showing the cliffs with troops and army tents at the bottom. Now the cliffs today.
The 25th of April was the day when Australia and New Zealand wrote their own pages into the Book of World History. But the first draft of that history was written by a very English Englishman. Ellis Ashmead Bartlett, a leading war correspondent and a colourful figure who would play a critical role in the story of Keith Murdoch's Gallipoli letter.
A photo of a dapper man holding a cane and with one foot perched on a wall. Dr. Jenny MacLeod, author of Reconsidering Gallipoli.
Ashmead Bartlett's a tremendously arrogant, conceited, interesting man. He's the sort of man that takes a silk dressing gown away to war with him and a case of champagne.
He comes out of his tent in the morning, the wonderful descriptions of him, in a yellow silk dressing gown, shot with red, calling for breakfast, which is provided by a cook and a restaurant manager from Paris. And he's spectacularly bankrupt at the beginning of the First World War, owing what in present-day terms would be £500,000, which he blames disarmingly on the high cost of loving.
He doesn't go ashore on day one, and yet in his first account, he's quite, you know, happy to say that the troops fought more bravely. I've never seen such bravery from troops. This thing, well, he didn't see the bravery from the troops. You know, if he did, he saw it through a very long pair of binoculars.
I've been in lots of wars where I've seen correspondents do very brave things, which have really not got them much because, frankly, they didn't have the gifts as wordsmiths to be able to make much of it. Well, Ashmead Bartlett certainly had the gifts as a wordsmith.
Though Ashmead Bartlett was the most colourful war correspondent at Gallipoli, he was by no means the only one. In marked contrast to the Western Front, Gallipoli was, from the outset, a media war.
At the beginning of the war, on the Western Front, the generals wanted no correspondence at all. And so when the war broke out, and for the first few months of the war, there were no correspondents anywhere near the front. And that's exactly how the generals liked it. Probably how they still like it today, one suspects. Ian Hamilton was different in that he actually welcomed the press and was willing to have correspondents attached to his force.
He believed in catching flies with honey, that if he could develop a good relationship with reporters, that they would report on his activities favourably, and that also they would abide more and more by his rules.
Everything they wrote had to go through this official censorship, and certainly they were not expected. You know, the rules of the game were you were not expected to be critical of what was going on.
A letter has been censored.
There's a huge amount of naivety among modern journalists about censorship. They inherently feel that there's something evil, wicked, about the idea of stopping journalists say what they want to say. Well, anybody who was around in either of the world wars would say, well, this, of course, is nonsense. And I don't think there's any reason to be ashamed of this. I mean, I always felt when I was reporting from the Falklands, I thought, this is my country's war. It's not like Vietnam or Middle East or all the other things I'd done. And until such time as I see people, the generals, screwing it up, it seems reasonable to try and hope that our side win and to try and take a reasonably positive view. Now, I'm not ashamed of that, although some of my colleagues at the time thought I was plumb wrong. But where I had an easy job was I never really doubted that broadly the British campaign was being sensibly conducted. It would have been a far more serious dilemma if one had become aware that it was being seriously screwed up.
Sir Max Hastings.
But in Gallipoli, things were being screwed up. Against the odds, Sir Ian Hamilton had managed to land his army on a hostile shore. But Turkish forces under German high command blocked its advance. At the Anzac beachhead, a brilliant Turkish commander, Mustafa Kemal, later known as Ataturk, led a series of bloody counterattacks that denied the enemy the high ground, locking the door to the peninsula.
They are stuck on the Gallipoli Peninsula. And it turns out that no amount of courage and heroism, no amount of men charging the enemy, is going to overcome that.
Within a few short weeks, Gallipoli began to resemble another theatre of war, 1,000 miles to the north.
It was a stalemate as bad as anything on the Western Front. I mean, it had been designed to sort of break the deadlock on the Western Front, and they actually reproduced it on the Gallipoli Peninsula under the worst possible conditions.
It's hot, it's desolate terrain, there are flies everywhere, dysentery breaks out, there are epidemic diseases. You get wounded, you get sick men who cannot be evacuated quickly and easily.
Bodies lying in a trench.
Places such as Lone Pine. It was a reeking, foul, stinking rat pit, as it was once described. Quinn's Post, much the same. You would have seen nothing but lines of bodies, corpses, bloated and rotting.
Bill Sellers.
There are flies in their thousands here. You could not eat, you could not drink, you could not open your mouth without flies seeking moisture inside your own mouth. The smell of the battlefields could be smelt from the boats well out into the bay. It was the smell of death.
A leg tangled in barbed wire.
Some people said he should have, right at the very beginning of the campaign, Hamilton should have said, no, this can't be done. This is an impossible task you're giving me. That wasn't in his nature, and I suggest it wasn't in the nature of any other British general at that time.
He can't abide a pessimistic point of view. He is the ultimate optimist. But in the messages he's conveying to London himself, to Kitchener, the Secretary of State for War, he's not giving the full story of what's going on in Gallipoli.
Hamilton thinks he will have the ability to define what the truth is. He is the general, he controls everything. His truth will prevail about the operation. And the question really is, how did Hamilton lose control of the telling of the story?
I liked General Hamilton and found him exceedingly kindly. But as a strategist, he has completely failed. I cannot see any solution that does not begin with the recall of Hamilton.
Keith Murdoch missed most of the Gallipoli campaign. By the time he finally got there, the fighting was all but over. But when it came to the battle over how the campaign would be remembered, he would be in the front line. At the outbreak of hostilities, Australian reporters had voted on who should accompany their troops to war, and Murdoch had lost by a single vote. And so, while the Anzacs charged the beaches at Gallipoli, Keith Murdoch was filing stories about the heroic work being done by civil servants in the War Department in Melbourne.
Keith was sorely disappointed to lose out on the role of the official war correspondent for Australia, having put himself forward, having canvassed for the role. But Keith was always pro-Australia, and if there's one thing that helps explain Keith's actions both during the First World War and in his later career, it was that paramount sense of patriotism, his Australianism, that really drove him forward in many of his aspects of his career and his life.
He was a fierce Australian patriot. He loved his country, and He loved writing about it and trying to take a leadership position. Not in a power-hungry way, but to try to influence the way he thought it should go.
Keith was torn. He had brothers who had signed up to go and serve over in the action. And he wrote a painfully honest letter to Andrew Fisher, the Prime Minister of Australia, asking for the Prime Minister's own personal advice on whether he should sign up as a soldier or whether he should carry on his journalism work.
Andrew Fisher's reply was to the point. The typewriter, rather than a gun, was the most effective weapon for Murdoch. Furthermore, he should grab an opportunity that had just been offered to him to run a news cable service for Australian newspapers based in offices of The Times in London. So Keith Murdoch was on his way back to Fleet Street. But on the way, he would make a detour that would be the making of his career.
The Prime Minister was a friend of his, said, well, will you try and call in Gallipoli? Because we're getting so many complaints from parents here about mail and whether the gifts are getting through and that sort of thing. So he said, of course, he thought it was a good opportunity to go there.
Dear Sir Ian Hamilton, I am proceeding from Melbourne to London to take up the position of managing editor of the Australian News Cable Service. At the Commonwealth Government's request, I am inquiring into mail arrangements, disposition of the wounded, and various other matters in Egypt in connection with our Australian forces.
Ostensibly, he's there to report on the mail service, but Fisher was concerned that the battle hadn't gone as well as it might have done, and that he was worried about parliamentary criticism, so he thought that he needed a bit of ammunition, a bit of first-hand ammunition, and Murdoch was the man to report it. To report on the atmosphere. Tell me what the generals, what the officers, what the men are saying to each other.
Professor Carl Bridge, historian.
In order to make a complete report, I should like to go across to Gallipoli in a semi-official capacity, so that I might also record censored impressions in the London and Australian newspapers I represent. Any conditions you impose, I should, of course, faithfully observe.
He is a journalist and a government insider, spy, agent, all of those things at once.
Also, may I say that my anxiety as an Australian to visit the sacred shores of Gallipoli while our army is there is intense.
He sets down the letter.
Of course, he arrives there in the aftermath of the August offensive. So is there when things couldn't be worse.
The August offensive was designed to finally break the stalemate at Gallipoli. A left hook launched from the Anzac sector would finally seize the elusive high ground, while diversionary attacks in other sectors and a massive amphibious landing of tens of thousands of fresh troops at Suvla Bay would give the Turks plenty of other things to worry about. It was bold, ambitious, and doomed.
A view over fields leading to the coastline.
How well I remember that terrible day when the blood stained the sand and the water.
In the present, a little blue boat glides across a calm sea. Now old footage of a ship crammed with troops.
We were butchered like lambs at the slaughter.
A small white boat heads for the shore.
Everything that possibly could have gone wrong did go wrong during these landings. Boats landing in the wrong place, boats breaking down on the way in, landing and not knowing where you were, attacking the nearest enemy that you could find, and might have found it was your own people you were attacking, this sort of thing. Total chaos and confusion.
Command and control broke down. Supplies and logistics broke down. You had cases of troops up on the flank here at Kirchtepe. Irish troops throwing rocks at the Turks 20 yards away. Unfortunately, the Turks weren't as blighted by the lack of supplies. They still had bullets.
Johnny Turkey was ready.
A photo of Turkish soldiers with heavy artillery, then three men cowering in a trench. A plume of smoke at sea, then old film of men stretchering an injured colleague down a walkway. Professor Peter Doyle, military historian.
As soon as the Suvla Bay operation was a total and utter failure, as soon as the left hook to break out from Anzac had played its course, then it was over. I think Hamilton's dead man walking.
A photo of Hamilton leading his troops.
This is an entry in Ian Hamilton's diary. It's dated the 2nd of September 1915. An ugly dream came to me last night. I was lying in my little camp bed, and yet I was being drowned, held violently under the Hellespont. Trembling, I carried back with me
into the realms of consciousness, an idea that some uncanny visitor had entered my tent. I could visualize the form of the presence, but the face remained hidden in shadow. For hours afterwards, I was haunted by the thought that the Dardanelles were fatal, that something sinister was afoot, that we, all of us, were pre-doomed. Mr. Murdoch, an Australian journalist, paid me a visit to thank me.
An Australian journalist paid me a visit to thank me for having stretched a point in his favour by letting him see the peninsula. Seemed a sensible man.
He seemed a sensible man.
A sensible man, yeah.
The photo of Keith Murdoch holding his hat. Hearing of the Dardanelles Commission.
How long were you on the peninsula?
Only a few days. 4 or 5.
You reported a great many things that were said. What did you know of your own knowledge?
I only formed impressions. That was all I ever claimed to have. I arrived on the spot with the conventional idea that it was an almost successful enterprise. That it was only a question of a short time before the peninsula would be in our possession. Therefore, I was not in the least prejudiced when I landed there. That is my point.
But you say you did form an impression. What was the impression you formed?
That the expedition had wholly failed. That the armies were in a powerless position. And that the situation was not receiving due consideration in London. And I acted on this impression to the utmost of my power.
Well, Gallipoli was so hopeless and so obviously hopeless. When I went there, it completely confirmed in me my sort of Australian emotions and the emotions that he felt, I'm sure. Just to imagine those thousands of wonderful young men. I think he identified with them. He wasn't very much older, perhaps 8, 9, 10 years older. He was a young man himself. He just felt very, very Australian, I think. So there's a degree of emotion in it, if you will. If someone from some other part of the world had gone there, they would have described it very much the same way, but without perhaps the emotion.
But Keith Murdoch was not alone, as he discovered towards the end of his brief visit to the battlefield. At the correspondents' camp, he met Ellis Ashmead Bartlett, the journalist who had first immortalized the landings at Anzac. But the many disasters since had turned a cheerleader into an outspoken critic.
Ashmead Bartlett goes rogue. He is, to some extent, a romantic. And, as sometimes happens in a romance, his love eventually turned to hatred, and he turned against Ian Hamilton and what he saw of the way the British Army was conducting the war.
Murdoch's arrival for Bartlett was an absolute godsend.
This is exactly what Ashmead Bartlett needed. This is a vessel that Ashmead Bartlett could pour all his venom into, and it is venom.
He was very impressed by British correspondents there who were appalled at what was happening but couldn't write their stories because of the censorship. And he agreed to smuggle a letter into London.
Typewriter keys.
Ashmead Bartlett believed in going right to the top. The letter that Murdoch agreed to carry was addressed to Herbert Henry Asquith, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
Dr. Kevin Fuster.
His ship arrives in Marseille. He's intercepted by military police because a spy in the correspondence camp had alerted the officers back at Gallipoli that he was carrying a letter or carrying something that he shouldn't have carried. So the military police intercept the ship in Marseille, go through his luggage, find the letter and confiscate it.
Murdoch's angst later was fueled as much by the way he was handled by the military police at Marseille as by anything else.
What the British military did was unforgivable: to intercept a letter addressed by a respected correspondent, a private letter to the Prime Minister, and to prevent this from reaching Downing Street, was an extraordinary example of military hubris, and Hamilton deserved to have been shot for that alone.
Sir Max Hastings.
I suppose you signed the ordinary declaration of the war, correspondent?
Yes, I remember signing something. I presume it was this.
And yet, when you left, you took a letter from Mr. Ashmead Bartlett.
Yes.
Did you not see that that was contrary to this declaration?
No, I do not think it was contrary. I think it was absolutely in accord with it.
Will you explain that?
It was addressed to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. It was a sealed letter and marked personal. I asked Mr. Ashmead Bartlett what it contained. He said it contained information for the Prime Minister. I think the position was such that I was absolutely justified. I did it in a perfectly open way. Which of those clauses in the declaration do you think it contravenes?
You knew that no communications were to be sent except after they had passed the censor.
I question that. I think the War Office agrees that a correspondent has a right to address a minister of the Crown.
I never heard of it.
I'm informed that is so.
Surely that does not apply to a man who, as a condition of going there, binds himself not to attempt to correspond by any other route than that officially sanctioned.
I did not correspond. It was not for publication. Is there anything here about carrying letters? Absolutely nothing at all.
I personally think that Ashby Bartlett and Murdoch called it right by making their first option to tell the politicians privately that this was a colossal screw-up and that the generals in command were not fit to hold their jobs, rather than trying to publish that. I think that was the right way to do it. But then, of course, when grossly improperly the generals intervened to prevent Ashmead Bartlett's letter reaching Asquith, the Prime Minister, monstrous behaviour by the generals to try and stop this, all bets are off.
Keith Murdoch feeds another sheet into his typewriter. Dr. Kevin Fuster.
When he gets to London, he then tries to rewrite the letter, but of course it changes because it's now his reflections as much as what Ashmead Bartlett had said to him. But he writes it to Andrew Fisher, the Australian Prime Minister, because that's what Fisher had said for him. You know, he wanted a report.
Dear Mr. Fisher, I shall talk as if you were by my side, as in the good days. Your fears have been justified. There has been a series of disastrous underestimations.
Now, it turns out the report he's writing is a rather different one than about Mail and the wounded. It's totally changed its focus.
At Anzac, morale is good. We are lucky in these men. The great fighting spirit of the race is still burning in. It is stirring to see them. Magnificent manhood, swinging their fine limbs as they walk about.
He is, in a sense, offering a nationalist spin to a disastrous campaign, saying the way this must now be solved to the Australian people, and the reign of clichés begins, a crucible of nationhood, a baptism of fire, our valour frittered away. Nonetheless, we have to be proud. The campaign has failed, but the Australian portion of it has been a grand success. It is a stand-tall moment,
a feel-great story within the context of a disaster.
Author Douglas Newton.
But for the general staff, and I fear for Hamilton, officers and men have nothing but contempt. They express it fearlessly. That, however, is not peculiar to Anzac. Sedition is talked around every tin of bully beef on the peninsula.
I think that any idea that the army was on the verge of mutiny was overplayed. I mean, I'm always amazed where the soldiers do things under orders, which, you know, we marvel that they would obey them. And if you take every single word that a soldier says as being desperately sort of serious and absolutely, this, if you were experienced, you'd realize that that was soldiers' banter.
The work of the general staff has been deplorable. One division went ashore at Suvla without any orders whatsoever. To fling them, without even the element of surprise, against such trenches as the Turks make was murder. An order had to be issued to officers to shoot without mercy any soldiers who lagged behind or loitered in an advance.
It's a slander on these troops going ashore that they were driven ashore by at the point of their officers' pistols.
I've never heard of being ordered to shoot people like that. I don't know where he got that from.
Murdoch was challenged before the Dardanelles Commission by one of the commissioners. He said, you're not telling the truth, Mr. Murdoch. And he said, well, I mightn't be telling the truth in detail, but I'm giving you a journalistic truth that is meant to persuade. So the higher truth is there if the detailed truth isn't. And that's what he was doing. It's a brilliant editorial.
Australians now loathe and detest any Englishman wearing red. Nothing can exceed the rudeness of these chocolate general staff soldiers.
He targets those to blame as British red tabs out of touch, British staff officers enjoying luxury and privilege as they have all their lives.
Their conceit and self-complacency are equaled only by their incapacity. But what can you expect of men who have never worked seriously, who have lived for their appearance and social distinction and self-satisfaction? They are unchangeably selfish.
Rupert Murdoch.
I think he saw firsthand, much more than he'd seen before, the sort of class system at work in Britain, and he felt it was totally, you know, unfair, people progressing without talent, and worse, once that progressed, contributing to the killing of Australians.
An old photo of a busy London street.
When he got to London, he got a little office in the Times. All the foreign correspondents used to work there. And in his first week, he was working away at his letter to the Australian Prime Minister when the editor, famous editor Geoffrey Dawson, walked in and said, "How are you, young man? What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm writing this letter to the Australian Prime Minister. Would you like to look at it?" And he said, "Yes." And Dawson read it and said, "Oh, can I show this to the chief?" Meaning Lord Northcliffe.
Lord Northcliffe, Alfred Harmsworth, is a very successful newspaper businessman. In 1896, he founds the Daily Mail, and the success of the Daily Mail and other ventures enabled Northcliffe to also buy the Times. His politics was that he was in favour of selling newspapers, but on the whole, he was not in favour of the Liberal government of Herbert Asquith that was in power at the time of the Gallipoli campaign.
So there is a desire to seek out a story and to make a story and to put the government under pressure, and that's exactly what the Northcliffe Press is doing. And Gallipoli feeds into that story very nicely.
He took his letter to Lord Northcliffe. Lord Northcliffe was very moved by it. I said, "I've got to take this down to Lloyd George."
Lloyd George has already begun his campaign, which essentially is a campaign driven by the idea that Asquith is an inadequate prime minister, and the conduct of the Gallipoli campaign is a reflection of inadequate government, of inadequate machinery for government,
an inadequate strategic direction. So, you know, Murdoch turns up at the right time. He's the man with a message which Lloyd George needs at that point.
And then it runs. It's picked up and run with by the editors, proprietors, the politicians in London.
I think I saw all the more active members of the cabinet. The majority of members were anxious to hear the case. I was informed the letter was printed as a cabinet document, and I know it was read. It created a sensation. Mr. Winston Churchill described it as lurid. It had a very striking effect upon the cabinet.
Within days of Keith Murdoch's arrival in London, his letter had been published as an official government document and was soon being discussed at the highest level by the British War Cabinet.
So we have here a document of the Committee of Imperial Defence, copy of a letter from Mr. K.A. Murdoch to the Prime Minister of the Australian Commonwealth, which is then discussed by the War Council only a few days later, on the 6th of October. And in this verbatim minute, we have the Prime Minister saying that as far as he was concerned, quote, "It was, however, a rather bitter document, and it was conspicuous for the omission of any praise for anyone or anything at the Dardanelles. And it was full of serious misstatements of fact." That actually is quite crucial, but as far as Lloyd George and the critics were concerned, why let a fact get in the way of a jolly good story? Barely a week later, on the 14th of October, we have another meeting of the Dardanelles Committee at number 10 Downing Street. Asquith, the Prime Minister, says it's necessary to reach a decision without delay regarding Sir Ian. That officer had had great chances but had been uniformly unsuccessful and had lost the confidence of the troops under him. Lord Kitchener replies, agreed as to the great difficulties under which Sir Ian Hamilton had been placed, but the necessity for replacing him existed, and he, Lord Kitchener, would do it with the greatest of consideration. He had done his best. My God, isn't that the obituary that's written over many failures in all walks of life? He had done his best.
Keith Simpson, military historian. Now an old photo of Sir Ian Hamilton sitting at the head of a rowing boat.
That was the end of the military career as far as Hamilton was concerned. He couldn't command again. People in that situation don't, as it were, come back.
Ian Hamilton's career is ruined after Gallipoli. He never has a fighting command again.
Rupert Murdoch.
He always said to me, I remember more than one occasion, he said, "I've never had a moment of conscience about what I did." He would have certainly regretted any inaccuracies, shall we say, or exaggerations. But as for the guts of it and the meaning of it and the impact of it, he was very proud and felt that, you know, he said he'd never had a moment where his conscience was troubled by this.
Professor Stephen Badsey, military historian.
Ian Hamilton always seems to believe that Murdoch's letter had something to do with his being recalled, because he hears about Murdoch's letter about 2 days before he gets the telegram recalling him. So he associates the two. But Murdoch's letter is part of a much general, wider mix of the debate at the time.
Murdoch's not the only person who is pushing this notion that things have to be to be rethought. But what, of course, is important about Murdoch is that, first of all, he is a journalist. In other words, it's legitimate for him to go public in a way that it's not legitimate for a soldier to go public. And secondly, he is an Australian. So there is a need, from the imperial government's point of view, to respond to an Australian pressure as well. If the report's coming back saying Australian lives are being lost, and uselessly lost, which is essentially, you know, the headline from Murdoch's what Murdoch's reporting.
Reluctant to call a defeat, the army spent another month before deciding finally to abandon the peninsula. In contrast to the campaign itself, The evacuation was a masterpiece of meticulous planning and flawless execution. The last troops withdrew on the 9th of January 1916, leaving the stony ground of Gallipoli sown with the bones of thousands upon thousands of the dead.
Withered poppy heads nodding in the breeze. A black and white photo of a soldier carrying a colleague over his shoulder.
Back home to Australia.
More photos of soldiers milling around covered bodies. Then ships full of the injured and men huddled up and trying to sleep.
And as our ship pulled,
a boat packed with Anzac troops.
I looked up.
Then men standing on a crowded raft alongside a wheeled cannon.
And thank Christ, there was nobody.
Soldiers standing next to a placard reading, "Willing to go."
And to mourn.
Then a large mound of skulls and bones in the middle of a field. And a stone in the grass today, to Trooper H. Rush, who died aged 23.
It never gets referred to as a defeat. It's a glorious failure. And I think that sense of Gallipoli as a romantic adventure lives on for decades and possibly even to this day.
Rush's last words were, "Goodbye, Cobber. God bless you." Dr. Kevin Fuster.
Gallipoli really established Murdoch. It meant that literally within days of arriving in London, he had access to all the major editors and proprietors, and dare we say, the politicians too. When Lloyd George took over as Prime Minister, the one exclusive interview he gave was to Keith Murdoch, which just shows how Murdoch, to his credit in a sense, used this amazing free kick, if you like, that he got to maximum benefit, and his career never looked back.
Sir Max Hastings.
I suspect that Rupert Murdoch, in his approach to life and to journalism and to Britain, has been profoundly influenced by his father's heritage. And God knows his father was extraordinarily effective, but certainly built into Keith and maybe into Rupert too, was that whenever Rupert sees a Brit, and maybe whenever Keith Murdoch too, the instinct is very strong.
Well, my father certainly shook up the establishment, and I think I've shaken them up over a longer period and a lot more. And I often wonder, you know, would he have approved of what I've done? Probably not sometimes, but times change.
After Gallipoli, Keith Murdoch reported on Anzac forces fighting on the Western Front. He campaigned in print and behind the scenes for the introduction of conscription in Australia. He returned to Australia in 1921 and founded a newspaper empire, accepting a knighthood in 1933. Modelling himself on his hero, Lord Northcliffe, he earned the nickname Lord Southcliffe. Sir Keith Murdoch died in 1952. It wasn't until 25 years later that the contents of the Gallipoli letter were made public.
Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, ooh, go a waltzing Matilda.